Mr. Imre Real 7, you were saying you had to provide guards.
Yes, we did. We had to provide guards and all sorts of escort duties for various bodies, government bodies and government individuals, to such an extent that it cuts seriously into our available strength for normal police duties. I shall hark for one moment back to Palestine over this, because I always recall Spicer in a lecture saying, and I can almost quote Spicer word for word. Spicer said, in the colonial police service, there has been a tradition in many territories for police to provide all sorts of services that are extraneous to ordinary duties. The police exist for the prevention and detection of crime. Those are the essentials. Anything else is extraneous and a nuisance. In Kenya, I managed, said Spicer, to get rid of most of the extraneous duties. I shall do the same here. But, he said, those of you who eventually go on to other territories may find yourselves bogged down in your police forces with these extraneous jobs that don't matter. They're a nuisance and they shouldn't be pushed upon the police. So that was Spicer. And in the Gold Coast, not very tactfully, I'm afraid, I approached this. And, of course, I got sat on fairly heavily because I was very junior indeed. I was just a junior cadet. And at that stage, it certainly wasn't for me to shoot my neck out on various institutions as I found them in my new colony. However, I did make quite an impact over this. And I'm happy to say that gradually, during the time that I was in the Gold Coast, we did get rid of most of these extraneous duties. And I believe that my not very tactful approach started the ball rolling. What did we do? We had, finding myself an officer, was strange at first. I think I missed, in the early times, the early months, I think I missed the camaraderie of the barracks in Palestine, of the give and take of being in the ranks. And I think I was, to start with, a bit out of my depth as an officer. But I was very kindly treated with much forbearance and toleration. And I shall always think kindly of those people who helped me over the initial hurdles. I was by far the youngest officer of the 35. One thing I did learn there very early on, which has always stood me in good stead. We had an officer, a senior officer, called de Carteret, and he was the number two in the force under Bamford. He was very keen on all officers becoming acquainted, well acquainted with the law, and particularly with court procedures. And one was expected to go into court as often as possible and not only to sit there and watch the procedure, but also to prosecute minor cases in front of the magistrates' courts. And I got onto this and found myself very keen about it. And I think this gave me a very good basic training on top of my Palestine training. I think it gave me a very good working basis for becoming, I hope, a reasonable policeman. There were various exams one had to pass when first joining the Gold Coast. One had to pass a law exam, which wasn't particularly difficult, particularly if you were keen about court work and court procedures, as I was. Anyway, I got through that very quickly. Then there was a language exam. I was lucky in being given the Hausa language to learn, H-A-U-S-A, Hausa. Well, now, Hausa land proper is northern Nigeria, the four emirates of northern Nigeria. But there were Hausa communities in most of the towns throughout the Gold Coast. And it was really a sort of lingua franca. Well, I managed to get through that without very much difficulty. Had I been given one of the other Gold Coast languages, I think I should have been in trouble, because they were very difficult indeed. But Hausa was relatively simple.
Were there any other lingua franca in the Gold Coast at the time?
There was no other lingua franca, no. You might say that a language called Twi, T-W-I, was perhaps the most widely spoken in the south. But there were there was a considerable disparity of language right through the whole territory. And the only one that one can say that was useful throughout the whole territory was Hausa.
I would have imagined that conditions were easier for policemen in the Gold Coast than in Palestine.
Oh, much, much. Very much easier. Now and again, there were factional riots, disputes, but they didn't amount to very much. There would be a lot of noise and tumult. A few people would get their heads banged and knocked about. The police would get out there, usually late, and then the whole trouble would die down. But by and large, no. I wouldn't say there were a great many problems. I did find an African inspector, when I had been there not very long, came to me with a large pile of case files. A case file being the documentary stuff on various complaints, and showing what had been done by police to investigate, let us say, a burglary or a housebreaking or whatever. And I was brought a large pile, about 40 or 50 of these dockets, case files, to be closed. And I looked through these gradually, and I found that very little had been done apart from the absolute bare necessities of taking the odd statements, very little had been done in the way of investigation. And I found this curious because on the training that I had had in Palestine, no officer serving under Spicer would have passed any of those, the investigations of any of those case files that I was now being shown. He would have asked questions, all sorts of questions, and would have said, has this been done? Has that been done? And something else. And he would have immediately given a very black mark to whoever had been in charge of the investigation. And here was I being asked to close as undetected or for some or whatever a whole lot of complaints, the documentary and all sorts of complaints, where it didn't seem to me anything had been done. And I made myself a bit obtrusive over this sort of thing too. I think with some effect. Another area...
Why do you think that they had been inadequately investigated?
Because from the dearth of information contained in these case files, I couldn't see that anything had really been followed up.
But why? Out of laziness?
I think out of sheer lack of instruction from on top. I think that there was insufficient impetus given to those who had to investigate to make them aware of what their job was.
With these faction fights, when you say the police arrived late, was that deliberately for their own safety?
No, it wasn't. There were, in those days, of course, there was no radio, no wireless. Telephones worked when they did work. I'm thinking at the moment of some fishing villages along the coast. It might have been some while before somebody who wanted to complain to police could get to a telephone. By the time police, very often, not always, by the time police got to these situations, the whole thing had evaporated. And all that was necessary for the police was to make sure it didn't start up again, and to collect the casualties, and to endeavour to see that law and order had started up again. Usually, if one was wise, one would get hold of an administrative officer and get him out with one, and he would deal with the local political consequences. And police would simply stay around until it was clear that a status quo had been set up again. No, it wasn't. There was no question of the men. The men would be spoiling for a fight, probably. It was purely and simply the geography of some of these villages were really rather a long way out. And by the time we got there, very often the thing was over. Though not always.
Which tribes were the police recruited from?
We had two brands of police in the Gold Coast. We had the Southerners were called the General Police. They wore peak caps with a red band round their cap, blue uniforms with red trimmings, and boots. They were the literates, and they were recruited from the southern tribes and Ashanti. They were supposed to have a set standard of education. Standard 7 I can't remember exactly what Standard 7 stood for, but it was quite a useful standard of education in English. And they did all the bookwork, the station bookwork, and were supposed to do the investigations. Then the other brand of policemen was known as the escort. The escorts were recruited from the northern tribes. They wore a red fez, khaki uniforms, puttees, and they had bare feet. They didn't have boots. They had bare feet in my time.
What were they called?
The escort police. And they did... it fell to them to do much of the patrol work. And as their name implies, they were employed on a great many specie escorts, bullion escorts, escorts into up-country areas, accompanying district commissioners, and so on. They were illiterate, for the most part, and they were mainly Hausa speakers. They were very smart, well turned out, and a very fine body of men. And we could put on, with the escort police, we could put on a parade that would not disgrace anybody anywhere. There was a great deal of emphasis laid by Bamford, Colonel Bamford, on the smartness on parade and a good turnout generally. And there's no doubt that they were as smart a lot of men as I ever saw in the Colonial Police Service.
How reliable were the police recruited from the population in the Gold Coast?
I myself did not have any cause to question their reliability until right at the end of my time in the Gold Coast. I spent 13 years there, it was not until a certain set of circumstances appertained after the war that anybody, I think, had any... I certainly had no cause to question their reliability whatever until right at the end. Perhaps we'll come to that in due course.
Should we do that now, do you think?
Perhaps now, if that's what you wish.
Perhaps we can start off with what were the circumstances after the war?
The circumstances after the war were fairly complex. The Gold Coast had provided a brigade to go coupled with the Nigerians. They had gone over to the East Coast, East Africa, and had taken part in the East African campaign in War II and also in the Burma campaign. They'd gone to Burma with the troops and fought against the Japanese. On their return, having gone through these experiences, they were a very different lot of men to what they had been when they first set out. They had travelled, they had seen active service, they had encountered all kinds and conditions of people, and when they came back to the Gold Coast, they found that they were back again, many of them, back in their old villages, And although government did everything it possibly could, I think, to resettle these men and to see that they were well treated after their behaviour, excellent behaviour overseas, because they had a very, very good reputation, the West African Brigade. They were regarded as crack troops. They behaved themselves admirably and with very great courage. Back again in the Gold Coast, government really did try to do what it could, but it was never seen as being enough by these men. And there was considerable dissatisfaction. This was roughly about 46, and this situation went on, climbing on, throughout 47 and 48. Now, it must be remembered that in 48, India, or 47 perhaps, India received its independence. And this was quite a milestone. Everybody in the Gold Coast knew about it. The fact of Britain having gone out of India was bandied about in the markets and all over. And, of course, this fact superimposed on everybody knowing that the policy of the Gold Coast government was to grant independence as soon as possible, had got people into a restless frame of mind. I recall that as early as going back as early as 39, a directive had come out from the governor, the then governor. At that time, it was a secret directive, supposedly secret, but I think most people had learnt about it. And it did proclaim that the policy of government was to enable the Gold Coast to be independent in due course. It didn't give a time limit on this, but it did set out very specifically the policy of government. So independence was in the air, both before the war and immediately after the war. This, coupled with the dissatisfaction that not enough was done for the ex-servicemen, was producing an all-round feeling of restlessness. I now go to the Colonial Office, and I talk now not from very much personal knowledge of it, although it's simply hearsay, but there was in the Colonial Office at the time a man called Sir Andrew, well, he was then Andrew Cohen, later to become Sir Andrew Cohen, and he was a protagonist of independence in the colonial territories. He was a very formidable man to look at. He was a great big elephantine person. I'd met him. In fact, I'd been at school with him originally. Cohen was very knowledgeable about colonial affairs. He was an undersecretary, and he'd made it his business to press for independence. He was very persuasive, and by 1940, 46, 47, he was carrying a tremendous amount of weight in the Colonial Office. He was listened to. And he was lobbying independence the whole time. There grew up in the Gold Coast a cabal of intelligentsia, lawyers, doctors, and top people, Africans, who knew about all this. The press were becoming more and more independence-minded, and not a day would pass without some reference to eventual independence.
Where did this cabal grow up, did you say?
Within the Gold Coast. They were Africans. They were leading intelligentsia in the Gold Coast. Then in Accra, there suddenly arrived a man called Kwame Nkrumah, whom nobody had really ever heard of before. This must have been 47, I think, I'm not sure. Now, Kwame Nkrumah was a very remarkable orator. He could sway masses of people. He had been in America. It was said of him that he'd been under communist influences. Whether that was actually true, I never really knew. I don't know. It's possible, but he certainly had the gift of the gab. And he hadn't been in the Gold Coast back from his travels, wherever he had been, for more than a very short time indeed, before he was making a name for himself. And everybody was beginning to learn of this Kwame Nkrumah. Large meetings would be held and the Africans would listen to him. There's no shadow doubt about it. So there you had a very powerful orator and potential leader. India, Kwame Nkrumah, ex-servicemen. Then there arose another factor. The cocoa crop. The Gold Coast depended very largely for its money on cocoa exports. A disease suddenly afflicted the cocoa trees throughout the country. It was called the swollen shoot disease. A government, in good faith, sent parties of administrative officers and agricultural experts through the country to talk to farmers and to leaders of various factions and so on, to try to persuade them that these trees must